Friends, I am excited to talk with you today about Book 3 of Paradise Lost. I feel like I say this about several of the books or sections that we discuss, but this is one of my favorite parts. So hopefully I'll be able to do it at least a bit of justice in this unusual format. And if you've read it closely and are spending time with it, I think you'll come to appreciate what Milton is after here. I want to open with a couple of reflections on the differences between hellish rhetoric and heavenly rhetoric, and then proceed by way of a sort of close reading of the invocation to light at the beginning of this book, and then look in some detail at the Son's speeches and at the way he and the Father converse, and then we'll kind of shortchange the last section of the book, but do read the whole thing. So one way of understanding what Milton is doing here in Book 3 of Paradise Lost is by recognizing that a precondition for persuasive, legitimate rhetoric, right, and rhetoric is just seeking to persuade someone else of something. So a precondition for legitimate persuasive rhetoric is a peaceful difference between beings, right? If people or beings, you know, I use beings here because we're talking about angels and divine beings and people, if beings can disagree about the right course of action and yet not be sinful, right? The cause of their disagreement is not sin. The cause of their disagreement might not be violent opposition, right? They just happen to disagree about a potential course of action, then rhetoric can be a sort of peaceful mode of crossing that difference via the gift of reason, right? Satan does not believe this is possible. For him, difference always involves competition and violence. Okay? Rhetoric, then, is always a cloak for coercion. So you're always trying to convince people so you don't have to beat them over the head, or so that you know, if they're stronger than you, you can trick them and get what you want. And hence, Satan can never accept God's good gifts and so enter into God's economy. Milton here is participating in a sort of larger debate, which I won't go into fully, but he's trying to recover a mode of humanism, and in particular, a version of the trivium, the liberal arts, and rhetoric as the capacity to enjoy and share in the good of the other, right? To achieve one's divine good in a relationship of peaceful difference. And this was already sort of challenged and backward in Milton's time as what was on the rise, this sort of new science of Enlightenment rationalism. And this is a sort of Baconian mode of a new science, a way of calculating, a understanding of reason as a way of calculation that controls and masters reality. So under this new science, and again, Francis Bacon or Hobbes are some of the key figures here, reason and logos and knowledge allow us to calculate and control and manipulate things in the world, and hence to impose our will on other objects. And so rhetoric is just another kind of technology, right? It's a way of getting what you want. So you find the right words that will persuade other people to do what you want, but you don't hope that rhetoric is a kind of genuine participation in a reality that is ultimately loving and peaceful. Okay. I could go on about this, these contrasting modes of rhetoric. But, you know, basically think about when you enter into a conversation with someone, are you trying to trick them into agreeing with you so that you can get what you want? Or are you genuinely trying to pursue the truth alongside them and open to the ways in which their comments or questions or ideas might alter your trajectory and change your mind, right? I think the challenge in our day, and this was already present in Milton's day, is that as technology becomes more prevalent and becomes a sort of default way by which we relate to one another, We tend to treat words as just one more technology, one more means of getting what we want. And this all too often is how words are thought about and described in, say, marketing departments, right? Or political discussions, right? What kinds of advertisements or speeches might make people buy my product or vote for my candidate? Rather than, how can I use language to participate with other people in this pursuit of the good? And just to give you a sense of how it is that technology kind of inframes our use of language all too often, I'm reminded of an example that Jamie Smith points to of a beer commercial, this Michelob Ultra beer commercial, I think it is, where someone gets up in the morning and the weather's not very nice, so he swipes right across his, in front of his face, kind of like you would swipe the surface of a cell phone, and the weather is drastically improved, and he goes down for breakfast and, you know, doesn't like what's for breakfast, so he swipes, and now he gets bacon and eggs. And it goes out to the garage, and he's got an old Honda Civic, and he swipes right, and he's got a, you know, insert your muscle car of choice. And he goes to the beach, and he doesn't think the girls on the beach are cute enough, so he swipes right, and they become much more beautiful. And then, of course, the commercial ends with him swiping to replace whatever kind of beer is there with the beer that the commercial is selling. But this idea is, you know, that we, the way that we relate to our cell phones, our smartphones, sort of habituates us perhaps to relate to the whole world in this way, in this sort of utilitarian, manipulative mode. And then the danger is that we bring that mode also into our relations with other people. So we've already talked some about how the debate in hell that Milton portrays in Book 2 is a species of this, right? Everyone's just trying to they have all these selfish desires, right? Some of them want sloth, want to just hang out there and minimize their suffering. Some are angry and want to keep fighting. Some want to resort to trickery and deceit. And of course, and they all cloak these selfish desires with highfalutin language in order to try to manipulate other people into agreeing with them. And then, of course, Satan, as the chief manipulator, his proposal wins. And then he goes and continues to practice this mode of rhetoric with his quote-unquote family, sin and death. And then with the umpire chaos, right? He continues to use his words to manipulate others. And so he's not at all shy about deceit. Well, in Book 3, Milton's going to rise to heaven, okay? And we're going to get a different kind of rhetoric. And Book 3 begins with a very famous invocation to the light, okay? And what he's invoking here is that light which created the world, that light who is the light of the world, Jesus, okay? Hail, holy light, offspring of heaven firstborn, or of the eternal, co-eternal beam, may I express thee unblamed? Right, and one of the great mysteries of the Trinity for Milton is that Jesus, the Son, is co-eternal, right? He is fully God and co-eternal, and yet he's also begotten, right? As the Creed has it, Jesus is begotten, not made. He is the firstborn of all creation. So what does it mean for some being, for some part of the divine Trinity, to be begotten? Well, the way, and Milton will talk about this more later, but the way that Milton imagines that tension, right, between the Son's eternal status and his status as the first begotten of God, only begotten Son, as John 3 has it, is that the other angels didn't recognize that the Son was fully divine until a particular event, until a particular day, however days are conceived outside of the earthly context, when God sort of elevates and reveals the Son as his only begotten co-eternal light, his image. And we'll get into those mechanics a little bit later, but just that's the zone, the paradox with which Milton is playing here in this opening invocation to the Son to light. Since God is light, and never but an unapproachable light dwelt from eternity, dwelt then in thee, bright effluence of bright essence increate. Right, that somehow the light is not created, and it is the bright effluence, the bright manifestation of the bright essence of God. How he's asking, how in the world can I write about God and his fully expressed image in the Son? What am I even trying to do? Is this even possible for a human to put into words what it would be like for two members of the Trinity to talk to one another? Right, they are the model for Milton for peaceful rhetoric, that these are somehow two persons, and yet they share a full being, right? They're one divine being, and yet it has, in this case, you know, he's focusing on two of the persons of the Trinity. Before the sun, before the heavens thou wert, and that the voice of God as with a mantle didst invest the rising world of waters dark and deep, one from the void, formless and infinite. Right, it is the Son, as John tells us. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. That's John 1. So Milton is riffing on that here. Thee I revisit now with bolder wing. Right, and this is sort of like what Dante does when he goes up to heaven. It's like, yikes. My poetry was okay for hell and okay for purgatory, but is it going to be good enough for heaven? Whew, I already got to up my game here. And that's what Milton's after as well. So it's a bolder wing here. Escaped from Stygian or hellish pool, though long detained in that obscure sojourn. Well, in my flight, through utter and through middle darkness, born with other notes than to the Orphean lyre, I sung of chaos and eternal night, taught by the heavenly muse to venture down the dark descent and up to reascend, though hard and rare. Thee I revisit safe, and feel thy sovereign vital lamp. But thou revisitest not these eyes that roll in vain to find thy piercing ray and find no dawn. And Milton, in this wonderfully personal moment, Milton says, God, I am trying to see and write about and describe your divine light, and yet no light touches my eyes. I am blind. I cannot see light at all. I remember light. And I remember that light, which is a reflection of or a metaphor for your divine being. But it's this wonderfully personal moment of longing for sight. And as we've seen before with Homer, the blind, apocryphally blind Greek poet, perhaps those who have lost the physical capacity for sight might gain in recompense a greater acuity of spiritual or poetic sight. And that's what he's praying for here. So thick a drop serene hath quenched their orbs or dim suffusion veiled. Right, that's how dark his eyes are. Yet not the more cease I to wonder where the muses haunt clear spring or shady grove or sunny hill, smit with the love of sacred song. But chief, thee, Zion, and the flowery brooks beneath that wash thy hallowed feet and warbling flow, nightly I visit. Nor sometimes forget those other two equaled with me in fate, so were I equaled with them in renown. And he's thinking here of these two blind poets, Thamyris and Maeonides, or Homer. It's another name for Homer. And then Tiresias and Phineas. So two blind poets and two blind prophets. And he's hoping, he's praying, he's pleading that his work might be in that tradition of the blind prophet poet, right? Then feed on thoughts that voluntarily move harmonious numbers, poetry, written in verse, as the wakeful bird sings darkling, and in shadiest covert head tunes her nocturnal note. Thus with the year seasons return, but not to me returns a day, or the sweet approach of even or morn, or sight of vernal bloom or summer's rose, or flocks or herds or human face divine, but clouds instead, and ever-during dark surrounds me. From the cheerful ways of men cut off, and for the book of knowledge fair presented with a universal blank of nature's works to me expunged and raised, and wisdom at one entrance quite shut out. Right? This is a deep lack in his life that he's no longer able to see. He can't see people. He can't see nature's works. Wisdom has one fewer entrance to Milton's mind now. A deep loss. So, much the rather thou, celestial light, shine inward. and the mind through all her powers irradiate. There, in my mind, plant eyes, all mist from thence purge and disperse, that I may see and tell of things invisible to mortal sight. Right, if I cannot have eyes on the outside of my head, if I cannot see the outer world, please, God, plant eyes in my mind that I might see the heavenly world. So it's a wonderful prayer for light, for insight as he rises to heaven. Now, one might still think, and I happen to think, that Milton, you know, for all the poetic genius that this book and the later books set in heaven contain, it might not be the most wise aesthetic choice to try to portray the Son and the Father in sort of human-like conversation, that there's a sort of inevitable sense of loss or almost blasphemy in trying to do that. So, I should register my dissent, I suppose, from Milton's method, even as I will now go on to argue its brilliance and what he accomplishes. Dante is much more humble, right? Dante never portrays the divine being in conversation. It's all mediated for Dante. And we talk about that, why that is. Okay, so we're now in heaven, and he describes the way that the Father and the Son are sitting up there, and they see everything, right? God sees everything. He sees Satan. He sees Adam and Eve in the garden. He knows what's going to happen, right? Satan is sort of unsure. He's on this mission, but God knows all. And then the Father addresses the Son on line 80, and he says, look, here's Satan, and I put limits upon him, right? I barred him in hell for his own good, and yet so bent he seems on desperate revenge that shall redound upon his rebellious head, right? If Satan had not burst the bars of hell, he would have suffered less. But as he perfects his revenge, as he continues to pursue this revenge upon us, he will only increase his own sufferings. So this comes again to what we talked about in book two. Why is it that God allows the bars of hell to be locked by sin, who is a sort of figment of Satan's imagination? Isn't this like having the fox guard the hen house? Yes, but it's because God leaves him free to either repent or to continue in sin. And as he continues in sin, his punishment will increase. Okay. And then God goes on. Satan's going to be successful. He will convince Adam and Eve to fall. Why? Because they're ingrate, right? That they are ungrateful. I made him just and right, Adam and Eve, just and right, sufficient to have stood, though free to fall. So Adam and Eve have the capacity to obey, and yet they also have the opportunity to disobey, right? Because that is the condition, Milton thinks, for genuine love and genuine obedience. If you don't even have the possibility of disobedience, then you're not actually being obedient, right? Milton says, whoever knew, you know, Milton says virtue is not actually true unless it's tested. So your obedience isn't worth anything unless you actually have a chance to disobey. Right? Otherwise, he says, he would have, Adam and Eve would have been passive and had served necessity, not me. Okay, so that's his argument. So, I'm not going to do anything for the fallen angels. God says that they were free and they themselves ordained their fall. And yet, man falls deceived by the other first. Man, therefore, shall find grace, the other, angels, you know, Satan and his friends, none. In mercy and justice both, through heaven and earth, so shall my glory excel, but mercy first and last shall brightest shine. So the Father poses, he sort of lays out the situation to the Son, and he says, look, it's our will to somehow show mercy to Adam and Eve because they fell through deceit and through temptation. But how are we going to maintain divine justice and divine mercy? How can we reconcile these two attributes of the divine being? This is a problem, right? And so the Father sort of poses the problem to the Son, and then the Son responds on line 144. And I'm going to read this, and I want you to notice that the speech here, so it's line 145, 144 to 165, and the speech here is composed of it's a sort of interlocking set of mirrored or chiastic sentences. So chiasmus is inverted parallelism, right? It's where you sort of begin with, you know, one image or theme or word, even proceed through a set of connected words or images to a pivot point in the middle, and then kind of like a sort of and then you work your way back out. So it's like A B C D, D prime C prime B prime A prime. Okay, so it's like you go in and then you go back out, and that's what's going to happen here. He's gonna begin with declaring that God is gracious and good. Then he's going to ask this question, how can we lose man? We can't lose man. Then he's going to have in the middle this chiastic declaration of God's justice. Then he's going to ask, that's the center, we'll talk about that in a minute. And then he's going to pivot back out to this question, how could we let man fall? We can't do that. And then he's going to conclude again with a declaration of God's goodness and greatness. Okay, so listen to this and see if you can kind of hear this turn in the speech. O Father, gracious was that word which closed thy sovereign sentence, that man should find grace. Right? Even in there, there's a small chiasmus. Gracious, word, sentence, grace. Yeah? So word and sentence are paired, and gracious and grace are paired. So gracious was that word. Turn, sovereign sentence, that man should find grace. For which both heaven and earth shall high extol thy praises, and with the innumerable sound of hymns and sacred songs, wherewith thy throne encompassed shall resound the ever-blessed. For should man finally be lost? Should man, thy creature late so loved, thy youngest son, fall circumvented thus by fraud, though joined with his own folly? That be from thee far. That far be from thee, Father, who art judge of all things made, and judgest only right. Okay, that's the pivot. I'll come back to that in a minute. Or shall the adversary, i.e. Satan, thus obtain his end and frustrate thine? Shall he fulfill his malice and thy goodness bring to naught? Or proud return, though to his heavier doom, yet with revenge accomplished and to hell draw after him the whole race of mankind by him corrupted? Or wilt thou thyself abolish thy creation and unmake for him what for thy glory thou hast made? So should thy goodness and thy greatness both be questioned and blasphemed without defense. Okay, in the very center, the Son alludes to, quotes Genesis 18, actually, where Abraham is pleading with God, or the angel. It's a little bit unclear exactly who Abraham is talking to, but perhaps even it's a sort of early manifestation of the Trinity. The angel or God tells him, here's Sodom and Gomorrah, they're bad, full of sin, I'm going to destroy them. And Abraham says, whoa. Look up Genesis 18 if you have time, but he basically says, Abraham says, wilt thou destroy the righteous with the wicked? That's not just, God. Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city, but thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? This is Abraham. That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Okay. And God says, okay, if there's 50 righteous, I won't kill them. And Abraham bargains him down and gets God to say, okay, if there's 10 righteous, I'll spare the city. And of course, there's not 10 righteous, so he doesn't spare the city. The idea there is that Abraham is pleading for mercy, pleading for God's justice to include mercy, right? God, it wouldn't be just if you killed the righteous with the wicked. And similarly here, the Son is saying, yeah, it wouldn't be just if we kill humans and undo all of our good creation because they have been deceived and tempted by the adversary. And in the middle, there's that far be from thee, Father, who are judge of all things made. That be from thee far, that far be, right? So be far, far be. There's this other chiastic turn. Why do I draw attention to this chiastic structure of the speech? Well, because two reasons. One, the chiasmus as a rhetorical structure is actually associated and has been for a long time, but before Milton's day, with the crucifixion. Okay, so it's a X-like rhetorical figure, and of course the crucifixion is itself, you know, the cross is shaped like an X. They begin with the same letter. And more precisely, more pertinently, they both involve a sort of reversal, right? It's like the Son is going into death, taking death upon himself in order to bring life. And the chiasmus sort of makes us go in one way, and then we turn around to come out, and it's all been transformed on the way out, the set of terms. So the Son seems to be gesturing toward, in the very form of his speech, the means, ultimately, by which the Father and the Son will work out and reconcile this tension between mercy and justice. Right? It's ultimately going to be on the cross that the divine persons will redeem human disobedience and sin. So already, in the very first conversation about this, they're ready, right? I mean, this in Revelation says the Lamb has been slain since the foundation of the world. That, you know, before the beginning of time, or when time began, from the very beginning, God knew that the Lamb would have to be slain, that the cross would be required to redeem creation. And also, the chiasmus is this wonderful figure, this wonderful rhetorical figure for reconciling paradox or competing elements. In this case, mercy and justice, right? How can God uphold his justice and extend mercy? Oh, that's going to be really hard. And it's in this chiastic structure the Son is able to sort of articulate that. So the Father then replies and says, yes, that's what I want to do. How are we going to do this? We need somebody, the Father says, to go and to... he says, Dahi, so against, let me read this part. This is line 203. Man disobeying, disloyal, breaks his fealty and sins against the high supremacy of heaven, affecting Godhead, right? Man pretends to be God, right? Like a God, I don't even want to know or want to determine good and evil for themselves. And so losing all to expiate his treason hath not left, but to destruction sacred and devote. He, with his whole posterity, must die. Die he, or justice must, unless for him some other able and as willing pay the rigid satisfaction, death for death. Say, heavenly powers, where shall we find such love? Which of ye will be mortal to redeem man's mortal crime, and the just, the unjust to save? Dwells in all heaven, charity so dear. Who wants to take on the punishment? Who wants to descend to death? Someone's got to die for this crime. Who wants to die? So just like Satan and Beelzebub sort of posed the question in hell, who's going to go corrupt earth? Who is going to go volunteer to pervert God's good creation? Now the Father and the Son pose the question in heaven, who's going to volunteer to go redeem creation? Who's going to volunteer to go die on behalf of humans, but all creation? And just in, and, you know, as in both places, there's this deep silence, right? Who wants to do this? Not a lot of fun. But Satan volunteers out of pride, right? He wants to be the one who gets, he's moved by monarchical pride, 2, 4, 6, 5. And here the Son is moved out of pure charity, pure love, right? So Satan volunteers for selfish reasons. The Son volunteers by love divine. And this, of course, parallels their contrasting motivations for speech, right? The Satan speaks with the desire to manipulate others to agree with him. The Son speaks out of love to allow others to participate in truth. This is the Son's next speech here, beginning on line 227, when he speaks up and says, I'll go, Dad. I'll go, Father. And I notice again, it's couched in the form of a long, complex chiasmus. Father, thy word is past. Man shall find grace, and shall grace not find means. Right there, find grace, grace find. So it sort of begins with this tiny chiasmus, and the whole speech is itself a chiasmus. At the end, I'll just read this now so you have in mind, there's an envelope structure. Of anger, this is on line 263, of anger shall remain, but peace assured and reconcilement, wrath shall be no more thenceforth, but in thy presence joy entire. So it's anger, peace, reconcilement, wrath. Right? Again, a sort of mini chiasmus, where anger and wrath are linked, and peace and reconcilement are linked. Okay, so I want you to see these. I mean, it's really remarkable. Again, Milton's blind, and he's putting together not only in blank verse, right, in poetry, in iambic pentameter, but also in all these really finely wrought rhetorical features. He is sort of embedding in the structure of the son's speech the means by which he will enact this redemption, i.e. the crucifixion. It's quite remarkable. Father, thy word is past, man shall find grace, and shall grace not find means that finds her way? The speediest of thy winged messengers, that visit all thy creatures and to all, comes unprevented, unimplored, unsought. Happy for man so coming, he her aid can never seek, once dead in sins and lost. Atonement for himself, or offering meet, indebted and undone, hath none to bring. Behold me then, me for him, life for life I offer. On me let thine anger fall. Account me, man. I for his sake will leave thy bosom, and this glory next to thee freely put off, and for him lastly die. Well pleased, on me let death wreck all his rage. Under his gloomy power I shall not long lie vanquished. Thou hast given me to possess life in myself forever. By thee I live, though now to death I yield, and in his due all that of me can die. Okay, so he's offering to be the sacrifice, right? On me, on me, on me. This is going to come up again later in the books, but just for now, note that the son is offering himself up as a sacrifice to pay the debt to death. Thou wilt not leave me in the loathsome grave his prey, death's prey, nor suffer my unspotted soul forever with corruption there to dwell. But I shall rise victorious and subdue my vanquisher, spoiled of his vaunted spoil. Death, his death's wound, shall then receive, and stoop inglorious, of his mortal sting disarmed. I, through the ample air and triumph high, shall lead hell, captive maugre hell, and show the powers of darkness bound. Thou, at the sight pleased, out of heaven shall look down and smile, while by thee raised I ruin all my foes, death last, and with his carcass glut the grave. This is going to be an image that recurs in a crucial speech, also chiastic speech, in Book 12, when Adam finally understands what the son will do to save him. And the idea is that by giving to death this holy, blameless life, the son will actually sort of turn death inside out, right? Death will eat that which cannot be eaten. And with death's carcass, the grave will finally be filled. It's like death will be turned inside out. Death will be sort of defanged by eating, consuming one who is spotless, who is holy. So it's this image where it's like, you know, instead of confronting death, you know, the son is not going to go down to hell and smack death on the head with a big club. We'll see that Adam actually expects there to be some sort of battle, well, for good reason, but that instead the son's ultimate victory over sin and death and Satan is not a violent fight, right? It's not that he's going to win because he's stronger or he's a better warrior. He's going to win through sort of turning death inside out. So on the one hand, this is another example of the sort of peaceful rhetoric, that ultimately peaceful persuasion is more powerful than coercive manipulation. That ultimately God is going to win, not because he's stronger, but because his love is the most powerful force in the universe, and it can actually make death collapse on itself. It's also, I think, an example of the way that he's going to defeat Satan, you know, by giving him enough leash to hang himself with. He's not going to defeat Satan forcibly. He's going to continue to give Satan and his minions freedom. And as they choose wrongly, their sort of evil plots will redound upon their own heads. And throughout the Psalms and the Old Testament, the prophets, there's this language of, you know, the wicked schemes are turned to naught and actually turned against themselves. You know, the evil man digs a pit for others and falls into it himself. It's that sort of logic that Milton's picking up on here, that God doesn't defeat Satan directly. He allows Satan to defeat himself. I guess there's also maybe some parallel here with certain forms of martial arts where you strive to use your opponent's momentum and strength against themselves. Something like that is going on here. It's a sort of jiu-jitsu move. Then with the multitude of my redeemed, I shall enter heaven long absent and return, Father, to see thy face, wherein no cloud of anger shall remain, but to peace assured and reconcilement. Wrath shall be no more thenceforth, but in thy presence joy entire. So there's this beautiful, sort of declaration here of divine shalom, divine peace, that will be restored after all the violence that Satan unleashes upon earth. So that ultimately peace wins and violence loses. But peace does not even win through coercion or through strength. Peace wins through love and through self-giving. All right, so think back to books 1 and 2 where Satan tells his minions, hey, we were just actually, God won because he's a big bully and he happens to be stronger. It's not fair. Tough luck. Well, the version we get in heaven is wholly different, not surprisingly, right? And this is why, you know, Milton is sort of critiquing classical modes of heroism. The way to be a hero, according to the Sun, is not to be a great military conqueror. It's not to be a trickster. It's not to be very cunning with words and manipulate and deceive others. The way to be a hero is to serve others, to give yourself, to give your life for others. And it's such self-giving love that is the greatest, that brings about the greatest victory in the world. I mean, this is a fitting mystery to meditate on during this Easter season, right? Where as Chesterton puts it, speaking of Christ's victory on the cross, Chesterton says, the cross cannot be defeated because it is defeat, right? It's this remarkable paradox that the very mode of victory over sin and death comes through what seems to be self-giving defeat. And yet this is the sort of mechanics that the Son and the Father discuss. So I want you to see here, this is why Milton thinks, peaceful persuasion is not only possible, it's actually the highest mode of rhetoric. He's sort of posing two different visions of heroism, the classical Homeric mode of glory and strength and cunning versus the Christian mode of self-giving, right? Where the greatest among you will be the least. And, now that I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also must love one another and serve them this way. All this Christian imagery of giving oneself and serving others. That's true heroism for Milton. And then, also think about the contrast between the Trinities. So in hell, the incestuous, allegorical, weird Trinity of Satan and sin and death, where they hate each other's guts and they're trying to, work out some way of appeasing each member. Of course, is contrasted here where there is real dialogue going on here. They're going back and forth, but also deep concord. Right, they're on the same page. Their enemy. It's not like the Son versus the Father. It's like the Son and the Father together trying to figure out how can we reconcile justice and mercy. That's the real challenge, right? So they're not against each other; they are working together to work out the means of this complex paradoxical truth. So that's the sort of shift in perspective. Okay, so, and there's this beautiful sort of canonic declaration here about the Father makes, line 300 and so. He gives, the Father gives the Son authority, right? And there's this idea that Satan wants to take all authority to himself. He of course famously says, oh, I'll be king here because in hell, whoever is the king gets the most... draws the fire from God, so actually no one else wants to be king. Perfect. Well, in heaven, The Father gives the Son all authority. He gives the Son kingship, and the Son gives the Father glory. There's this beautiful dance of giving and of mutual love. No one's trying to claim power or cling to power. Then all the angels that are left sing. They sing in glory of this Father. And then Satan, we go back to Satan. He goes through the paradise of fools. Think of the paradise of fools as basically this sort of dump out in chaos, out in the cosmos, where all those people who sought vain things, all those people who put their hope in the wrong things, end up. There's a complex. It's a weird spot. Then Satan comes to. He sort of begins to approach creation and the sun. Let me pick up here on line 540. Satan from hence, now on the lower stair, that scaled up steps of gold to heaven's gate, looked down with wonder at the sudden view of all this world at once, as when a scout through dark and desert ways with peril gone all night, at last, by break of cheerful dawn, obtains the brow of some high-climbing hill, which to his eye discovers unaware the goodly prospect of some foreign land first seen, or some renowned metropolis with glistering spires and pinnacles adorned, which now the rising sun gilds with his beams. So Satan's first glimpse of creation is like, you know, this mountaintop view of this incredible vista. Such wonder seized, and he is seized with wonder at its beauty. Note, and we'll pick up on this theme later, note the role of beauty in Milton's epic. That beauty is that which comes the closest to converting or changing Satan's mind. That beauty is more powerful than force. You know, God cannot defeat Satan or cannot persuade Satan to repent and return to him through swords and force. And it turns out that Satan will not be persuaded through beauty either. But he almost is. That beauty is more powerful than force. That peaceful rhetoric and its appeal and its invitation to others to join in this pursuit of the truth and the goodness and the beauty is more efficacious than seeking to manipulate or coerce others. And that is the great good mystery for Milton. That peaceful rhetoric seems weak and yet is so powerful, right? That it seems weak when the Son submits to the cross, and yet it is in that that submission to death that he actually conquers death. That's the wonder. Such wonder sees, though after having seen the spirit malign, but much more envy sees that sight of all this world beheld so fair, right? Quickly his wonder and admiration is turned to envy. And then he goes to the sun, right? He lands on the sun, and he has this conversation with Uriel about the earth, and he lies to Uriel and gets Uriel to tell him where he should go, and Uriel doesn't recognize him. So who is the first, you know, sort of reading through the book, who is the first being to be deceived? It's not Adam and Eve, it's the angel Uriel. Okay, contingent finite creatures can be deceived, and that is not a sin. It's not a sin to be deceived. Right, Uriel does not disobey, and this sort of, you know, parsing out of in what sin lies precisely and what's the role of deceit in sin becomes crucial later on. But I just want you to note here that Uriel is deceived and does not sin. That and likewise, Adam and Eve could be deceived by a smarter, you know, more experienced Satan, and they still wouldn't have to sin. All right, so, and we'll see, you know, what are the conditions that might help those even who are deceived avoid sin. But I think that's an important, you know, that's an important plot point that Milton wants you to catch, that being deceived isn't necessarily in itself sin. One more thing here, just in order that I kind of know who's hanging with these lectures and can reward you for sticking through to the end. If you're still listening, email me and tell me your favorite quote from book 3. I like this line. And if you email me the favorite quote, then I'll give you 2 bonus points on your daily work. And I'm giving all of you right now basically full credit for the questions and answers. So those grades are coming up. But here's another opportunity to continue to improve your grade. And in addition to knowing if you're hanging in with my lectures, it will also give me a glimpse at what you're appreciating. You know, what imagery or line or insight is standing out to you, which I always find interesting. And I miss, you know, one of the joys, I think, of reading these books is that I always read them with new students. And so I get to experience them through fresh eyes each semester. So I miss that. Reading this by myself in my home is not the same as discussing it with you in person, where we can have more genuine give and take. So I'm still trying to think about ways that I can, make my own experience of this reading in conversation with you and respond to your questions and observations and insights in ways that will make these recorded lectures and our Zoom conversations have a bit more give and take and back and forth. All right. I hope you enjoyed book 3. I look forward to chatting with you via Zoom about book 4 on Friday.